I don't know if it's good news or bad news, but I do know that when this tangent series of tangents or these statements that are connected by the Amora's name as opposed to by the contents is over, we have another one coming. And after that, I think there's another one. So I did want to make one comment, though, in response to a conversation that took place before the shir, and which was the nature of this agada. And I think Rabbi Feldman had cited in the conversation that the Rav used to skip, the Rav skipped right over this.
They skipped from the first Mishnah to the second Mishnah. We didn't even look at it.
I have to say that when I was in yeshiva as a student, that might have been my inclination or reaction. But as I have gotten older, I've come to think that that is unfortunate. It's a very common attitude in the yeshivas. Most Rabbeim, they get to the Agada and they skip it. But I think it's rather unfortunate because Agada speaks to the deepest issues that animate our lives. Agada really is the philosophy, the machshav of Chazal. Right. And it's unfortunate that in the world of the yeshivas, it in some ways plays such a peripheral role, certainly in the base medrash itself. And I think the notion of divorcing halacha from Agada is unfortunate, to put it, to say the least. So anyway, we still have a while in the Agada. And we begin with the statement that I might have mentioned last time, but we'll resume with it. The Amar Rabbi Chelba, Amar Rabbi Rahuna, again, 12 lines from the bottom of Vavam Ubeis. Kol Hanena Misudas Chasan Ve'eno Misamcho. Anybody who derives benefit from the Suda that a Chasan makes, and the Chasan is the one, as we pointed out last week, who pays for the Suda. Anyone who's Nene, who derives benefit and does is not Misameach, the Chasan, is not Misameach, the Chasan and the Kala, is over b'chamisha kolos. He violates, over you means to violate, five kolos. So what does it mean to violate five kolos? So Rashi just says, mizalzel b'chamisha kolos, and the Gemara will explain in a moment what that means. Shabirech b'makadosh baruch hos Yisrael. He's making light, he's minimizing something that's tremendously important, the five kolos that God blessed the Jewish people with, at least in the context of wedding, of the simcha of a wedding, shenemar, kol sason, v'kol simcha, kol chasan, v'kol kala, kol omrim hoduas Hashem tzvakos. Right, so this is, pasuk is from Yirmiyahu, this is God's promising to restore Yerushalayim, where people will once again celebrate weddings in Yerushalayim, and there are five times it says kol. Everybody knows the first four kolos, kol sason, v'kol simcha, kol sason, v'kol kala. But then this additional pasuk, kol omrim, the voice that says, give praise to the Lord of hosts. So the question is, all right, so then the Gemara says the following. V'imisamcho, okay, but let's say you do what you're supposed to do. You go to a wedding and you make the chasan and the kala happy. So maschara, what is the reward? So Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, zocha l'torah, shenitna b'chamisha kolos. One merits to attain presumably knowledge of Torah, appreciation of Torah of some kind, that was given with five kolos. What are the five kolos that the Torah was given with? Shenemar, vayihi bayom hashlishi. These are psukim from Parshas Yisro, which I know at this point it may be only a dream, but you know, if somehow a nation happened, we're in Shul for Shavuos, so we'll read this on the first day of Shavuos. Vayihi bayom hashlishi, it was on the third day, Bios aboker, in the morning, vayihi, and it says, kolos uvrakim. Kolos counts as two so far. There was voice, sounds and thunder. V'anon kaved alahar, and a thick cloud on the mountain. V'kol shofar, the sound of the shofar, that's kol number three. The first kolos is plural, counts as two. Kol shofar is three. Then, later, vayihi kol hashofar, the word kol a fourth time. And finally, when Moshe would speak, ohayelokim, Ya'anenu v'kol, that's five kolos. So the question is, before we go further in the Gemara, what does this mean? What is the connection between being mesameach chasan and the five kolos of matan Torah? What is? I mean, just it seems kind of random. So I think the connection is not at all random. So when one is at a wedding and one is not mesameach chasan v'kala appropriately, so it fundamentally represents a failure to recognize the significance of a relationship, the significance of a union of husband and wife. Perhaps someone thinks, oh, big deal, another couple getting married, what's the big deal? There's somehow a failure to understand how unique and significant this relationship is between a husband and his wife, and between a wife and her husband. What is Maim at Har Sinai about? So we, you know, I like to say, I'm not the only one who says this, that one of the dirty words in modern Orthodox education, general community, is God. We don't like to talk about God. We like to talk about halacha. We like to talk about mitzvahs. We don't like to talk about God and having a relationship with God. We tend to think, and that's true, not sure that it's true in the Haredi world, but that's a very like Christian thing. They're always talking about, you know, what does Jesus want and their relationship. But the truth is, it's a tremendous loss that we don't talk about the Ribbono Shel Olam. We don't talk about God. We don't talk about our relationship with God. And really what Maim at Har Sinai, what the giving of the Torah represents, is the covenant between God and the Jewish people. And the metaphor that is used for this, most famously in Shir HaShirim, as Chazal understood it, is the relationship between husband and wife. Chazal read the entire book of Shir HaShirim, the Doda and the Raya. The Doda is a god, in effect, the husband, almost the boyfriend, and the Raya, the girlfriend, the wife, represents the Jewish people. So Maim at Har Sinai represents basically a marriage between a Kadosh Baruch Hu and the Jewish people. It represents a certain kind of covenant. A person who is able to understand the nature of the relationship of what a marriage is between Basar V'dam, between humans, is someone who is more easily, or it's a gateway to having an understanding of the an appreciation of the relationship between God and humankind, and God and the Jewish people specifically in our case. And that's what it means, that someone who is Mesamea Chasam Nekala, he's Zocha Chamisha Kolos. That's the kind of person whose sensitivity already, one who appreciates and values the relationship we have with the Ribbono Shel Olam, is the one who is primed to acquire Torah. Okay, Amar Rabbi, so that's what the five kolos are. Now the Gemara just challenges it because there are actually more kolos that are found in the parsha of Matan Torah. So there are more than five, in which case if there are more than five, it's not going to match up with the five kolos by the Chasam and Kala. This kind of reminds me, for those who might have been doing the Daf Yomi a few weeks ago, so the Gemara has a debate as to where malachos come from in the Mishkan. We know, according to the Mishnah, that there are 40 minus 1 malachos, 39 malachos that are prohibited on Shabbos. So the Gemara asks on Daf, I think, Memtes, Samad Aleph, and Shabbos, where do the 39 malachos come from? So one opinion, there are two opinions in the Gemara, but one opinion in the Gemara is that there are 39 times it says malacha, the word malacha in the Torah. And the Gemara immediately debates that there are at least 40. In fact, I believe there are more than 40. But the Gemara wanted to know about two particular malachos, which is counted and which means something else. So I believe if you take out a concordancia, you know, it's a book that, you know, lists every word in Tanakh and it groups them by words. I think there are more than 39 malachos. I've never bothered to sit down and figure out which one of those 39 count, which don't. So the Gemara basically has the same question here. The Gemara says, the last word on the eighth line, on the ninth line from the bottom. Ini, what do you mean? There are only five kolos that are said by Maim at Har Sinai v'aksiv at the end after the Aseres HaDibros, the first pasuk. The chol ha'am ro'im es hakolos. So you see that you got to add two more. There are seven kolos by Maim at Har Sinai. So the Gemara answer says no. Osam kolos the kod matan Torah. The Gemara's answer is no. The story is over after the Aseres HaDibros. When the Torah says, and the entire nation saw the kolos, that means the kolos that were mentioned in Parshas Yisro before Maim at Har Sinai. Okay, fine.
Rabbi Weider?
Yes.
I know Rabbi Lichtenstein often tells us that to wait to do the right thing for people is often just to show up, whether it's Shiva. So you might have thought here by Chasun and Kala, the mere fact that the person's at the wedding constitutes Misameach the Chasun and Kala, almost like, you know, like sort of in the category of Panim Chadashos, in that sense, just being there. So apparently you have to do something more beyond just showing up to the wedding. Also, I think the intended audience is kind of the Litvak, you know, the who sort of comes to a wedding, has a little, he brought his Gemara there, and sort of he's... As the festivities are going on, he's sort of, looking and perusing his Talmud. So he's being promised that, you know what, if you pick yourself, your eyes up from the Talmud and go actively, Mesameach Chasun and Kala, it actually will enhance your Torah. You'll get the promise of the five kolos of Torah if you leave your Gemara for a while and actively, Mesameach Chasun and Kala.
So I know that the first half you said is certainly an astute observation. It's clear it's not just showing up, because if in order to be nenemi sudas chasan, you have to show up, which means you have to do something on. That's correct. As far as the cold-hearted, soulless lit fox, I've never seen someone show up at a wedding with a gemara to sit there learning during the dance. Well, during the chuppah is one thing,
but somebody
sit at his table and be learning his gemara. I will say that person is in a lot more trouble than just that he's not mesameach chasam kala. I think he's kind of, to sit at the table when they're dancing with the chasam kala, when he can dance because he has to learn, he kind of has missed the boat. But yes, okay, fine. And now, closing the section, Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak Amar, Ke'ilu bana echa b'churvas Yerushalayim. One who is mesameach chasam v'chala is like he has rebuilt one of the destroyed homes in Yerushalayim. She'nemar ki ashiv eshvus ha'aretz kevarishona omar Hashem. It's the end of this verse. This whole verse of kol sason v'kol simcha is God says, when I will restore the captives of the land, when God will bring back the Jewish people been exiled and place them or establish them kivarishona. And I would say that this is really consistent with the idea that Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi introduced, that to rebuild Eretz Yisrael, to rebuild a Jewish society, which means rebuilding a relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam, requires an appreciation of what that relationship is supposed to be. Okay. All right, so that's the end of this statement of Rabbi Chelb on the name of Rav Huna. Now,
are you suggesting that we form an opinion of God based upon a relationship between husband and wife, or what it should be? Or should it be the other way around? A relationship of the husband and wife should be a picture, a mirror image of the relationship between Israel and HaKadosh Baruch Hu.
I'm not sure which one. The problem is that Ribbono Shel Olam is not a person. So it's very, when you have a relationship with another person, there is a very clear, not always so clear, not as clear as always we'd want communication, back and forth. It's hard to talk about what exactly is the nature of the relationship with Ribbono Shel Olam, where sometimes it's not a conversation that takes place in tandem. God has spoken once, and we now have to figure out and listen what he asked from us. And we speak to God, but we don't necessarily get a response. If I would say one thing, one thing that we can learn, and from the Gemara that we learned on the previous Amud, that you can learn from the relationship between the Ribbono Shel Olam and the Jewish people, is that the commitment is supposed to be unconditional. That is the only thing I can say. But more than that, the two relationships are not the same because our experience and the two of them are not the same.
Why this is Agarita.
I will leave the rest of this to the rabbi and his drasha. Yes, Sam.
Is this wrong? Is this implying that the to be bona, the achas mechurvos Yerushalayim, is actually more important than chasan v'kala, saying simchas chasan v'kala, because it says, in other words, if you think that being mesameach chasan v'kala is so low, no, it isn't. It is just like you built one of the churvos of Yerushalayim. But I think you might have had it the other way around today. People might have thought that building, you know, a neighborhood is actually less important than the relationship between a husband and wife. In other words, we might have said that building the churvos of Yerushalayim is like being mesameach chasan v'kala, not the other way around. What is the greater value?
I don't know that the Gemara here. I think that what the Gemara or Nachman Bar Yitzchak is suggesting is that people may take lightly the mitzvah Simchas Chasam Mekala, but most people certainly in that context would have understood it, being in Bavel and being at the time of the Churban and Yerushalayim being destroyed, everyone would have understood that there was great value in rebuilding brick by brick Yerushalayim. So I don't know that it's saying one is greater than the other. It's simply a way of communicating to people that this is something very important, because you understand building Churvos Yerushalayim is important, so too is Mesameach Chasam V'kala. It doesn't have to be an exact equation. Okay. Now the Gemara continues. a more puzzling agada, and I'm not sure what to do with this, but I'll make one suggestion. The Amar Rabbi Chelbo, Amar Rav Huna, Kol Adam Sheyesh Bo Yiras Shamayim, a person who is a true God-fearer, Dvarav Nishmaim, when he talks, people listen. He's like E.F. Hutton. I don't know if that, I date myself on that one, but when E.F. Hutton talks, people listen. So a person who's a Yiras Shamayim, his words are heard. Shenemar, Sof Davar Hakol Nishma. This is the last pasuk in Koheles, or the second to last pasuk, but we read it again at the end. That when all is said and done, Es Ha'elokim Yira V'Es Mitzvosav Shemor, fear God and observe His mitzvos. Kizeh Kol Hadam. This is what all humanity is supposed to be about. That's what the pasuk says. And the Gemara is interpreting Sof Davar Hakol Nishma is Es Ha'elokim Yira. If someone is fearing God, then his words will be heard. And the question is, why is that the case? So I wanted to make just one suggestion along the following lines. What is the definition of Yiras Shamayim? We always talk about, people talk about, he's a Yiras Shamayim. He's a God-fearer. But how do you know that someone is a God-fearer? And the truth is, you never know that someone is a God-fearer, because the only way, there is a way, but generally speaking, you only know that someone is a God-fearer if you know what they do and nobody else is looking except for God. The Gemara later in Brachos, I think at the end of the fourth perek, says that when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was on his deathbed, so his students came to visit him, and one of the things that transpires is they ask him for a bracha. So he says to them that your yira of God, your fear of God, should be equal to your fear of man. And so you can imagine these very firm Talmidim, you know, look at the Rebbe and they say, that's it? I mean, we shouldn't fear God more than man. We should be much firmer than that. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai looks at them and says, listen, when a person is about to do an Aveira, what do most people do? We look Vayifen Kovacho. We look around and see and ask, is anybody else looking? We don't say, oh, is God looking? I'm not going to do it. So the real barometer for you, so Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, if you fear God as much as you fear man, you'll be in pretty good shape. But the definition of Yiras Shamayim is what a person does when no one else is there to see. The five times in the Torah, all, I think it was in, I don't know if there are any, next week's parasha, we're going to have a couple. Achrimos Kedoshim we had, I think, the others. Five times the Torah says, V'yareisa me'elokecha, you should fear God. In each of the five circumstances, Rashi comments that Chazal note that these are all things where the action itself is ambiguous. It all depends upon the internal intent. And you never know what's really going inside a person's, what's their intent. So if I give a person a piece of advice, I tell them, you should sell, Rashi quotes, Lifnei Iver Lo Siten Mesho, you shouldn't put a stumbling block in front of a blind person. So you come to me for advice. Chazal understood this not just literally, primarily, but metaphorically. You shouldn't trip someone up, not in a physical sense, but cause them to do an Aveira. You shouldn't give them bad advice. So someone comes to me and asks me for advice, and I have a stake in the matter involved, and I don't tell them that, and I give them advice that's good for me, that's not good for them. But the truth is, on the surface, I could explain my advice in many different ways. I could make an argument this way, I can make an argument that way. So when I give advice, that person has no idea and can never prove that I only did it because I had a vested interest in it. So the real barometer for Yiras Shamayim is what a person does when no one else is looking. When the next week's parsha, this coming week, Parshas Bahar, will read, Lo sonu isha samiso. You're not allowed to inflict emotional pain upon someone. So the truth is, sometimes you say something and it can be not intended. You could say it in such a way where it's perfectly innocent and perfectly appropriate. Or it could be done to stick a stake in someone's heart. And how do you know when a person says it? Well, you can't know. Only that person knows what's inside their heart, what was their intent. So the Torah tells us, V'yareisa me'elokecha, because this is a davar which is only masur l'shamayim. Only God knows what my intent was when I did such a thing, when I said such a thing. So that is really the definition of Yiras Shamayim. So the only way you find out of whether someone is Yiras Shamayim or not is if somehow you get a camera to what's going on when they think no one else is looking. When they think no one else is looking and they do what they do, that's when you find out whether a person is truly Yiras Shamayim or not. And it's because of that, I think, that Chazal say that someone who is a Yiras Shamayim, Dvarav Anishmayim, someone who people view, someone who exudes Yiras Shamayim, and again, sometimes we're fooled, So if his words are listened to, because everybody, we know, whenever we have a conversation, you have a conversation about money, about politics, about this view, the other view, we all know that people bring to the table their own biases, their own interests, their own self-interest. But a person who has Yirat Shamayim is the person who sorts out his or her own self-interest. They give honest advice. They give honest counsel. What they have to say is at least what, they may not be right, but it's what they truly believe. No one looks at them and says, oh, he's only saying that, not because he believes it's true, but because it's convenient for him, because it's for his or her own benefit, but rather because that person sincerely believes it. So they can be wrong, but at least I know when that person speaks, they're speaking with genuine honesty, what their genuine and honest appraisal of what's going on in the world. So that's what I think it means, that kol adam sheyesh bo yirat shamayim, that people know that when they talk, they're not speaking, you know, figuring out ways to get themselves ahead, but they're speaking what they genuinely believe is the truth. So then dvarav nishmayim, such a person with such a reputation, their words will be sought out for counsel. Okay. So now that's the easy part. The next part is the part that's a little difficult. This Gemara, for those who happen to be doing Daf Yomi, it also appears verbatim in Shabbos. The Gemara asks, "Mai kizeh kol ha'adam?" What do the last words in that verse mean? Because this is all of humankind or humans. What does it mean, kizeh kol ha'adam? So the simple meaning probably is, by the way, that this is the purpose of humankind. This is Yiras Hashem and Shmiras HaMitzvos. So not so far from that, the Gemara understands that this is talking about the individual who is a God-fearer. And Amar Rabbi Elazar, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Kol Ha'olam Kulo, Lo Nivra Ela B'Shvil Zeh. The entire purpose of the creation of the world was for this one Yirei Shamayim. Okay. Now, I understand that if that's what, for whatever reason, that the perfection in human existence is fear of God. So that's the only reason God created us, so we could try to achieve some type of spiritual perfection. I understand that. But now the Gemara has two more statements, which are similar, but I'm not sure exactly how they're different. And I have one suggestion. Then the Gemara quotes, so this was Rabbi Elazar. Now the Gemara quotes toward the end of the fourth line from the bottom, Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana Amar, Shakul zeh kineged kol ha'olam. This person, if you were to evaluate the person's worth, that person is worth as much as everybody else in the world. So it's not quite as exclusive, right? The first thing is the world was created just for this person. Now we're saying, here's the rest of the world, those who are not the true God-fearers, here's the one God-fearer, and they're kind of shakul, they're equal. And then the third statement. Rabbi Shimon ben Azai Omer, which is kind of funny because he's a Tana, he's much earlier than these figures. Va'amri la Rabbi Shimon ben Zoma, he's still a Tana, same generation. Rabbi Akiva is contemporaries. Kola olam kulo no nivra ela litzevet or litzeves lazeh. The world was only created as to be a tzevet, to be an accompaniment for this person. So each one
we of don't them, have litzedek.
What's that?
I have lamed tzadi vav vav tov.
Yes, tzevet, like when they yes. talk in Moshava camps, they talk about the tzevet, the staff. It means the people. Tzvas means company. I suspect, by the way, it's related to a word. I don't know if we saw this word once before. I think in Mishnah Avos, there are 10 things that were created bein hashmashos. I don't know if anybody remembers that, but one of the 10 things that was created in Ashmashos was Tzvas B'Tzvas Asuya.
Yes.
Now, firstly, that's a basic anthropological statement, and the assumption is that in order to make metal, you need metal. So how did they make the first metal tongues if they had no metal? So the anthropological answer of the Mishnah Avos is God made in Ashmashos the first pair of metal tongues. Then what is the term Tzvas for tongues? So it's probably that's spelled Tzadi Beis Tav, but that in rabbinic Hebrew, it doesn't matter. It's probably the same as Tzadi Vavav Tav. What do tongues do? You grab something, you hold it together. So that's what a tzevet is, a staff. It's a kind of a group. And in rabbinic literature, it often means to keep company. So Benzoma's statement is that not that the world was created just for this person, not that this person is equal to the rest of the world, but the rest of the world was created to accompany, to be accompaniment for this individual. And the number of the Achronim here actually quotes, I don't think Rashi does, I think the Marsha quotes a Gemara about Ben Azai, I think it's later in the Masechta, that he used to get up and he would go out into the Shuk And he would see, you could buy everything in the shuk. Now, he had his profession. He taught Torah, whatever it is he did. And he spoke about, he gave thanks to God that all I do is I wake up in the morning, I do what I do, but all these people have prepared all these good things for me, right? They've created all this stuff for me. So here he is, the Talmid Chacham. He doesn't plant, he doesn't plow, he doesn't make clothing, but he walks into the shuk and it's all been prepared for him. So they connect it to this idea that kol olam kulo nivra ela tzeves lozeh, right? It's everything else is sort of an accompaniment for this person who has Yirat Shamayim. So all of these statements on some way focus on the centrality of the individual who is a Yirat Shamayim, who is a fear of God. But the question I have to ask, and nobody really, Rashi certainly doesn't comment, a satisfactory explanation, what's the difference between these three statements? The first is the person, the whole world was just created just for him. Then he's equal to the rest of the world. And then finally, the rest of the world is company for this person. So I wanted to suggest the following. That in some ways, this represents, I'll say, stages of spiritual development. The first stage is the most egocentric one, which is the person, the student, who enters the Beis Medrash, who enters Frumkeit, is engaged in things that are Yirat Shamayim, and the person thinks that the entire world exists only for him or her. That's the most sort of egocentric view. Eventually, the person starts to grow up, or more to mature, and starts to understand that, no, there are other things in the world, and those things have value as well. So everything else in the world, you know, I do what I do, I'm separate maybe, and they do what they do, and each one is necessary, you know, but the two never meet. And the last step is the person, the Yirat Shamayim, who recognizes that not only is the rest of the world shakul keneged what he does, but it's essential for what he does. In other words, he doesn't exist separately from the rest of the world. Kol ha'olam kulo lo nivra el tzeves lazeh. He looks at him and says, listen, what I do is important, but I can't do it without the rest of the world accompanying me. There is a statement that we read in a siyum. I think it's found later in the Masechta, somewhere in the second or third perek. So we don't recite it in the siyum. I take that back. But the Gemara speaks about the tfilos of the various Amoraim when they used to finish their davening. I'm looking to see if I can catch a quick glance. Yeah, so the Gemara happens to be, if you have a Gemara in front, if you have a full brachos in front of you, if you turn for a moment to Daf Yud Zayin Amud Aleph. When we recite a siyum, there's a passage we recite that I have to admit I'm uncomfortable with, I don't like, and some of it was added later, but not all of it was added later, which we say that we give thanks to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he made our portion in Torah, and we say, She'anu amelim v'heim amelim, we toil and they toil, anu amelim mekablim schar, v'heim amelim v'ein mekablim schar, they work but they don't reap schar, anu rutzim, and this part's the part that's added later, which is really sharp and nasty, anu rutzim, we run, v'heim rutzim, and they run, but anu rutzim l'chayim abba, we're running to olam abba, v'heim rutzim l'ver shachas, and they're running to the pit of despair, and they quote the pasuk, you know, from David's wish that God should drag all his enemies down. Now, that's one sentiment, that is the idea that I'm engaged in Torah study and everybody else is theft. But here, the Gemara happens to be on the last of the median lines on Yud Zayin Amud Aleph, the fourth word. Margala bepumayu de rabbanon diyafne. There was a pearl, a precious saying in the mouths of the sages of Yavne. Ani beria, I am a creature of God, a created thing of God. V'chaveri beria, and my friend is a creature of God. Ani malachti ba'ir, my work is in the city, teaching Torah. V'hu malachto basata, and he works in the field. Ani mashkim malachti, I get up from my work. V'hu mashkim malachto, he gets up early for his work. Kishen shehu eno misgader b'malachti, just as he doesn't try to infringe upon my work, not only to do it, but to belittle it, kach ani eni misgader b'malachto. I don't infringe upon his malacha either. V'shem atomar, maybe you'll say, ani marbe, I do much more, I'm more spiritual, I learn more. V'hu mamet, he doesn't do very much spiritually. Shaninu, we have a Mishnah that teaches the Menachos, echad hamarbe v'echad hamamet uvavan shi'chavein sliba l'shamayim. But we don't measure, people have different tafkidim, people have different jobs, people have different pursuits and vocations in life, and one is not, even a Talmid Chacham is not supposed to belittle that which other people do. So I think that what this last statement represents is a sort of in that spirit, Rabbi Shimon Zoma says, that it's easy to belittle what everybody else does because you're a Talmud Chacham. This is what you do. You're a Yirei Shamayim. But until you realize that you can't do, it's not just that your fellow works hard. You can't do any of the things you want to do if not for the accompaniment of those people. And that's the most mature spiritual stage of the person to merit spiritually. First, the egocentric stage, then the recognition that there is maybe some value in what other people do, even though you have nothing to do with it. And finally, the third stage in which you recognize that your very continued existence and spiritual growth is dependent upon the accompaniment of the rest of the world. Okay, that's what I would like to suggest.
Beautiful.
Sure it will be for some other rabbi's sermon, some other type of a sermon.
That's very good.
Now, I'd like to add two things I learned from the Rav, Rabbi Weider.
Please.
On this subject. One is in an essay called Shlichus. It's the first essay in the book Yemei Zikaron. If you don't have it, I will be very happy to send you a copy. It's a whole series of essays of the Rav. The first essay on Shlichus is worth the whole book. I've preached on it. It's affected my life. It's
The book only published because of that essay, or it's equal to the rest of the essays in the book?
Call a safer shove for that shuckle. And it was worthwhile. I mean, look, the rest of it is wonderful too. That one resonated with me tremendously, and it's just absolutely gorgeous. Apparently you're not familiar with it. So I'm happy to get you a gift of that sefer. If you don't read anything else in it, read Shlichus.
Okay. So now both please share.
So one of the things he quotes is this mimer, Ani Brio v'chaveri Brio. And his point is, we don't know what our Shlichus is. Our Shlichus is from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And unlike in a human shlichus, it doesn't have a beginning and it doesn't have an end and it doesn't have an exact purpose. We don't know. We have to be ready at any given time. I'm not going to go into the whole essay, but in terms of value, you can't compare values because you don't know what in the end is important and so on. He talks about Rachel and her incredible that God is ready to bring all of Bnei Israel back because of Rachel. Rachel mevako al baneha, and God listens to her. And the Rav says, what's so great about Rachel? Avraham, Yaakov, Yitzchak, Moshe. And he gives the example of Rachel giving the signs to Leah. And he says, maybe that was the reason why Rachel was. The point is, we don't. And he quotes Anibrio v'chaveri Brio right there. That's one thing. The other thing, he had us when we were learning in the 3-year plan that he started out when I happened to be in yeshiva. We had to read the Hakdama LePeirush HaMishnayos of the Rambam. And it's a storehouse of information. But one of the things there that I'll never forget, the Rambam says, "Lulei ha-mishtagin hayaha olam charev." If not for the mishuganas, the world would be destroyed. And what he means is not what we might think he means. He says, the whole purpose of mankind, humankind, is to learn Torah and to be a Yirei Shamayim and so on. And yet, most people are spending all their time making a living. But he says exactly what you said then. This Talmud Chacham, this Yirei Shamayim, couldn't survive if not for all these people who are going around making a living and who make it possible for him to go to the shuk and buy so he can survive. And the Rambam says, Lulei ha-mishtagin, these mishagoyim who are working whatever their job may be, Hayaha Olam Harev, the world would be destroyed, because the world is kept going for this Talmud Chacham and this Yirei Shamayim. That's why God keeps the world going. But he couldn't go, he couldn't survive if not for the work of the other people.
Thank you. Okay. No, yes.
So no. I owe you a sefer.
The phrase, Kol HaOlam Kulo, how common is that in the Talmud?
It's a pretty common phrase, I think.
We have Nachman Breslov. I thought, well, if it's only in this context, he's almost saying, you know, Kolom Kulo Geshra Tzara Ma'od, that do you think that fearing God is such an easy thing to do? No, it's not, but it's like crossing a narrow bridge, but you can do it, you know, don't be afraid.
If I remember, I'll do a Bar Ilan search, but I think it's a pretty common idiom. Yeah. Okay. So now we have one last statement of Rav Chelba Amar Rav Huna. Amar Rabbi Chelma Amar Rav Huna, Kol sheyodea b'chaveiro shehu ragil liten lo shalom, yachtim lo shalom. If you know that someone always tries to give you shalom aleichem, which you first, you should try to beat them. Shenemar bakeish shalom v'rotveihu. You should try to get ahead on it. That's the positive. V'imnasan lo, if one greets somebody else, v'lo hechzir, so nikra gazlan. If you give someone shalom, the person doesn't respond. So then you're a gazlan. Shenemar ve'atem bi'artem hakerem gizelas he'oni bevateichem. So Yeshaya is criticizing the Jewish people. He says that you have totally consumed what was in the kerem. The theft of the poor is in your house. Gizelas he'oni. So the pshat probably means that the gifts in the vineyard, the parrot and the ololos, these people stole. They harvested their entire vineyard and they didn't leave the parts that go to the poor. But Rashi says here, Gezeilas he'oni, Rashi explains that, what do you mean the theft of the poor? Theft of the wealthy is also theft. He says, what is Gezeilas he'oni? It means you steal from the poor person who doesn't have anything to steal. So what did you steal from him? It means Shalom Aleichem, the thing that actually doesn't cost anything. The one thing he has that you couldn't return to him was to return his greeting. So that's called Gizelas Ha'oni. It's not just a poor person, but not returning someone's greeting. I'm actually reminded here, Rashi's comment about Gizelas Ha'oni, there's a pasuk in Mishlei, it's a kind of very interesting pasuk. It's a little ambiguous. It says, Al Tigzal Dal Ki Dal Hu, which could mean, literally means, don't steal from the poor because he is poor. The pshat in the pasuk probably means that you would steal from the poor because he's vulnerable. In other words, don't say because he's poor, I'm going to steal from him because nobody's going to stand up for him. Because the next pasuk in Mishlei says that because God is the one who's going to stand up for the poor, right? But you could read the pasuk a little bit along the lines of that famous line about they asked Willie Sutton, why do you rob banks? And the answer is because that's where the money is. And the pasuk in Mishlei could be read as, don't steal from the poor person. You know why? Because he's poor. Why would you break and enter into a poor person's house? There's going to be nothing to take. Go to a rich person's house. So in a certain sense, that's gzeilas ani here, right? What can you steal from the poor? They have nothing to steal. Al tigzal dal ki dalhu. So Rashi says gzeilas ani actually refers to not an ani, but anything something that even an ani would have, which would be basically his dignity, acknowledging him as a person. So a person greets you. So it's a form of gzeila, form of theft, not to return the greeting. And you see, by the way, Chazal were pretty machbit about this. We would never do this today. But when we, God willing, get to the second parak of this Masechta, so the first Mishnah speaks about what happens when someone walks over to you in the middle of Kriya Shema, they walk into Shul and they say, Shalom Aleichem, what do you do? Right? So our standard response would probably, which the truth is today, most people have the sense that you don't interrupt someone the same Kriya Shema. They might shake your hand. Shaking your hand might be an appropriate response. But the Mishnah is going to talk about, depending on where you are in Kriya Shema, between the brachos, between the parashas, or in the middle, who you respond to, how you respond to them. Rabbi Yehuda's position, which is the one we technically paskin like, even though nobody does this anymore because people understand today, is that you if someone walks in when you're in the middle of Kriya Shema, you can be if you're not in the middle of a parasha, if you're at a break, you can be shoal mipnei hakavod, someone who is, you're supposed to honor. You can stop, you know, you just said yotzer hamaoros, you haven't started avarabah, and you say shalom aleichem, you know, Rabbi Lookstein, or shalom aleichem, you know, to your father or somebody like that. And if someone else, no matter who the person is, they could be the lowliest person in the world, and they say shalom aleichem to you, then you're meishiv
shalom l'chol adam.
Meishiv l'chol adam. You could, so you're talking about, you're in the middle of Kriya Shema, so in the middle of a parsha, so then you're only shalom ne'ayir, someone you truly, maybe Rabbi Muvak, maybe, I don't know, and meishiv, you only respond ne'akavod. But at least, you know, you already said baruchu, and you're between brachos, you're between parshas of Kriya Shema, and Chazal say that to any human being who says shalom aleichem, you respond, because to not responding is generally a bad thing, and it has to be weighed against, you know, where you are. Right? We don't say in the middle of davening, in the middle of Shemoneh Esrei, you don't respond to anybody. Right? Even the Melech Hishol B'Shlomo, you don't respond because you're talking to God. But at different stages, we have different levels of when you're supposed to respond. But the only reason we consider interrupting in various parts of Tefillah to say Shalom Aleichem is because not being Master Shalom potentially means being called a Goslin. And it's certainly a Kal Vachomer. This has never been my experience in KJ, but it has been my experience sometimes walking in the streets in my own community. And some shuls have the reputation. You walk in, nobody says hello to you. So, I mean, the truth is, if you don't say hello, I guess that it also, they're not gazlanim, but it means the first part of the statement is relevant. And even if someone is not ragil to give you shalom, you should always be makdim shalom to every person. Okay.
I apologize for the lack of video. Statement. Gezeilas ha'ani, when it comes to saying hello to human emotions, no matter how rich you are or poor, we're all poor when it comes to emotional support. Even your money doesn't give you the comfort that someone saying hello to you gives you. So in some sense, everyone needs this and needs to be supported, even if you're very rich. You know, when it comes to the building of human relationships, don't assume that just because something is rich, he doesn't appreciate a shalom aleichem. He's in need of it also. You know?
Well said. Correct. I think, Sam, I would just say, I think that particularly in this time, we all understand the need for human connection. Doesn't mean poor, rich, or anything else. Yes, well said. Okay, so now we are turned to the top of Bav Zayin Amud Aleph. The good news is we finished all the statements of Rabbi Chelbo Amar Rav Huna, and now, which started in the middle of Vav Amud Beis and went all the way to the bottom, and now we're going to start with a series of statements, Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Yosei. A whole series of these statements. I'm going to confess that the first statement, the first section, is one that I quote often, but I don't understand at all what it means. It is an incredibly powerful and enigmatic statement of the Gemara, so you have to kind of hold on to your metaphorical hats for this one. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Mishum Rabbi Yosei. Rabbi Yochanan says he had a tradition, not directly, again, Mishum. I think Mishum Rabbi Yosei ben Zimra, actually. It may not be Mishum, I think Rashi somewhere says, I don't know where. Mishum means it's not a direct quote. It's in the name, there are people in between.
Passed down, tradition.
There's a tradition. Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Yosei ben Zimra. Minayin shahakadosh baruch hu mispalel. How do you know that God davens? I don't even know what this means. I'll comment in a moment, but let's first talk about, since at least I can play with we can play with the psukim. Shenemar, v'haviosim el har kodshi. God promises in the redemption. We say this on Yom Narayim many times. It's the haftorah in Dirshu on the fast days. V'haviosim el har kodshi. I will bring him to my holy mountain. V'simachtim beveis tefilasi, and I will make him rejoice in the house of my prayer. Tfilosam lo nemar, it doesn't say in the house of their prayer, but ela tfilosi, mikan shakadosh baruch hu mispalel. So apparently, God has a tfila as well. What does this mean? By the way, the Gemara is about to ask, what's in God's sitter? Hold off on that one for a second. What is
Rabbi, in the parsha where Moshe sees the back of Kadosh Baruch Hu, doesn't he see tefillin? That Hashem is wearing tefillin also.
Yes. So we learned that Gemara that Kadosh Baruch Hu wears tefillin was a daf ago. But that's tefillin. That's its own issue. The Gemara talks about, we learned on the bottom of Vav and Aleph, what are written in the parashios of God's tefillin. Okay, that's one thing, but what is it? So it's tefillin, okay. So there you only have to deal with the anthropomorphic problem. God isn't physical. Okay, so the metaphorical tefillin.
Now that he's tefillin, that he's mentioned tefillin, is the, are the two words related, tefillah and tefillin?
The singular of tefillin is tefillah. I'm not sure what the connection between the two is. It is the same word. But I don't know what the connection is. But it's one thing for God to wear tefillin, you know, allow the anthropomorphic metaphor. But who is God davening to? You know, we daven to, we're supposed to turn to God and we pray.
Who said you have to daven to someone? It's the very behavior. There's something, I don't know why he's dignifying or humanizing, well, humanizing that for God. There's something about that activity that refines the doer, not that God needs to be refined.
Kivayachal.
But the kivayachal, is that, that saying that God doesn't have, that God has human attributes, is that more of a Greek notion that has sort of injected itself into Judaism?
Hold on. Let's take this slowly, Sam. So the first thing you said, which is correct, it has been pointed out that the word tefillah, mispalel at least, which is the way it's used in biblical Hebrew, is reflexive. There is a position of the Rambam, which I find to be in the Moreh, which I find to be very disturbing. I fundamentally reject it, even though I think that it's true a lot of the time. I can't accept it the way the Rambam presents it. But it may resonate with some people, which is that for the Rambam, the problem in tefillah is God is unchanging. And therefore, what does it mean that God will change his mind? So for the Rambam, tefillah is really for the prayer, for the person doing the praying. It's not about changing necessarily God's decree or changing what God is going to do. Now, I have a problem with the Rambam. That is very, very Aristotelian, Sam. I have a problem with it because it seems to run against the bulk of rabbinic and biblical literature. Right? There is clearly, it's very hard to explain how reading Tanakh and reading Chazal, there isn't the notion that at least sometimes God responds to our prayers. Now, of course, what's useful about the Rambam is it would explain if it seems that most of the time God doesn't seem to respond to our prayers, then what is the function of prayer? And the answer is prayer is not necessarily about changing the outcome, but it's about the prayer, him or herself. Now, if you do adopt that approach, at least, Sam, and that's where you were, I think, going, Sam, if tefillah has a value independent of just you're praying to someone, but the value, I'll call it the introspection of tefillah, I can start to understand. I'm not going to go much further with this, other than there is a passage on the Rashba that's cited in the Ein Yaakov. The Ein Yaakov, for those who are not familiar, is a work where they basically, I don't know when it was written. It was probably, I want to think it was written, I don't know, 15th, 16th, sometime century, something like that. The Ein Yaakov was basically took the Gemara, the entire Talmud Bavli, and cut out all the halachic material. For those who are familiar with the Rif, it's like the opposite of the Rif. The Rif came along, and he wrote a sefer by cutting out all the agadic material and all the back and forth, even the legal material, to give you mostly the end. And Yaakov took out all the halacha, stripped it away, and left only the agada. Rabbi Feldman, in light of your comments earlier, the Rav probably would not have wanted to give shir out of the end Yaakov, because there would have been nothing but agada. So there are a number of commentaries in printed. They print Rashi and they print the Maharsha, which we have in the back of our Gemara, the Chidushi Agadus of the Maharsha, and there are some other commentaries. So in there, they cite a passage from the Rashba. The Rashba himself offers an explanation I don't understand, but before he does that, he cites the Gaon. I don't know, I assume it's Sadia Gaon. I'm not sure. He doesn't name which Gaon it is, who basically says what the Gemara means is that God doesn't pray, but God models for us, right? But one of the central values, if not halachos, of Judaism is halacha bedracha. We imitate God. We imitatio Dei. So he points out, the Gaon points out, that when at Maamad Har Sinai, Moshe asked God for something. And we may talk about that a little more later and in this Gemara. But God says to Moshe, Ani avir kol tu, he says, Ani avir kol tuvi apanecha v'karasi v'shem Hashem l'fanecha. It seems that what God comes, passes before Moses, and he teaches, Chazal say, he teaches Moshe Rabbeinu the Yud Gimel Midos. He says, in a time of anger, this is the prayer that you use. So in effect, what God does, that's what the Gaon says this is referring to. God here, the prayer of God, is the Yud Gimel Midos. And he's only doing that to model for us what we are actually supposed to do. Okay, that's hard enough to understand as it is. The Rashba goes off somewhere. I'm not sure I fully understand the Rashba, and therefore I'm not going to attempt to explain it. Suffice it to say, this is a very, very difficult Gemara. What it means,
Rabbi, there's another variation of the Rambam's opinion on tefillah, which is from Yosef Albo.
Okay.
Says that it's not that you're, is that that God has different gzeirot depending on the spiritual level of the person, and that with tefillah you change your spiritual level, and so you're tuned into.
Right. I understand. So I understand. So that is almost a way of preserving a Maimonidean outlook, but preserving a biblical outlook, right? But the Rambam is often quoted is very, very hard to swallow, right? That already is just that's an Aristotelian version of biblical prayer. How's that? Okay, but here, in fact, I think is a very, very powerful part. My mitzalei. Okay, God prays. That's hard enough. What is God's tefillah? We have Shimon Esrei Brachos in our tefillah. What is God's prayer?
Why do you think it's used mitzale and not just the same root of, you know, palel? It started with mispalel. No, why did you go to mitzale? I know mitzale means to pray, but I'm just asking, is there any significance at changing the, from mispalel to mitzale?
No. The answer is because the previous part was a statement of the Amora, which is usually in Hebrew. That's the general rule. In the Gemara, that's a statement of a Tana, actually, certainly is going to be in Hebrew, but even Amoraic statements, the Maimra itself tends to be in Hebrew, very rarely in Aramaic, but the threads that join the Gemara together, the editorial layer of the Bavli is Aramaic. That's why it's my mitzale. It's the Gemara talking anonymously, setting it up, right? You'll notice, though, it quotes an Amora who's talking in Hebrew again. So my mitzale, what is God's tefillah? Amar Rav Zutra Bar Tuvia Amar Rav, God davenius yehi ratzon milafanai, whatever that means, sheyichbeshu rachmai eskasi, that my mercy shall suppress my anger, v'yigolu rachamai al midosai, my mercy should in effect roll over my midos, meaning presumably midas hadin, and v'esnahig imbanai b'midas rachamim. I should engage with my children in judging them and in punishing or not punishing them with the mercy, the attribute of mercy, ve'ekones lohem lifnim mishuras hadin. I should interact with them doing lifnim mishuras hadin, going in effect beyond the letter of the law. By right, we did X, we deserve Y as the result. But nonetheless, God should go lifnim mishuras hadin. I like to cite this particular tefillah in the context of Yamim Noraim, and in context of talking about what it means lifnei mishuras hadin, we actually do echo this language a little bit in the Machzor. At the end of the bracha of Zichronos, we ask God to remember the Akedah, you know, the Akedah Asher Kavash Avraham Esrachem Avakadis Yitzchak Malgabei Mizbeach. On the Chabash Rachamav Lasos with some Chabal Levav Shalem. Then we ask, Kein Yichbeshu Es Rachamechas Kascha Me'aleinu? We ask God that his mercy should suppress or conquer his anger. And I always like to say that in general, when we deal in life with people, people would say, well, I don't have to do Lefnei Mishuras Hadin. It's true. But if we insist upon doing din with other people, when we come on Yamim Noraim and we ask God for forgiveness, if we were judged Lefnei Midas Hadin, we're goners. The only way we can survive God's judgment is if God engages with us in Lefnei Mishuras Hadin. So how dare we ask God to do Lefnei Mishuras Hadin with us if we're not prepared to engage that way with other people? You can flip it around as well, that this is the obligation of Lefnei Mishuras Hadin, which for some Rishonim is obligatory and even enforceable in a Beis Din, is actionable, is a reflection of a Mitati Odei. Right, it's an imitation of God. God engages with us, allowing us to live in the Lefnei Mishuras Hadin, so we are expected to do the same thing.
Okay. That's the same idea as with Mechila. We should be Mochel other people, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu should be Mochel us.
Correct.
Which is a little bit of Lefnei Mishuras Hadin sometimes too.
Correct. Sometimes, yes. Okay. And probably Rabbanim of Kehilos probably have many times they should be mochel, even though they shouldn't be mochel. Okay. So the Gemara has one more piece in this. We'll conclude with this, which I think actually has been made into a song. I forget who made this into a song.
Avram Fried has a great song on that whole, Sheikh Beshuva, Rahamai.
It bothers me. You'll see. We're about to read it. It's the Gemara. It's the next Gemara. It somehow bothers me deeply that this has been made into a song. This is an Agada. I don't really understand this, but now we read it. It's very similar and related. Tanya, on the eighth line, Amar Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha, who was the Kohen Gadol, Pam Achas, one time, Nichnasti, Lahaktir Kitores Lefnai Lefnim. It was Yom Kippur, and I entered to burn the Kitores that we burn inside the Kodesh HaKadoshim on Yom Kippur. Viraisi, and I saw Akasriel, which seems to be some name for God. Certainly, the word Keser is in the middle there, crown. Ka Hashem Tzvakos, I saw the Lord of Hosts there. Shehu Yoshev Al Kisei Ramanisa, he was sitting on an exalted throne. The Amar Li, and he said to me, Yishmael Bini, my son Yishmael, Borcheni, give me a bracha. Again, what does it mean to give God a bracha? The Rashba talks about this, but I can't say that I fully understand. Amarti lo, Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha says, I said to God, Yehi ratzon lilfanecha, sheyich b'shu rachamecha es kascha, that may your mercy suppress your anger, v'yigolu rachamecha abidosecha, and your mercy should override your other attributes, your midas hadin, v'sisnaheg imbonecha, you should engage with your children, v'midas harachamim, v'tikones lahem lefnim mishuras hadin. The same thing as God's prayer, basically. And then the Gemara concludes, v'ni ani alei birosho, he nodded with my head, he acknowledged my bracha. V'kamash malon, shelo tehe birchas hedyot kala be'enecha. That the bracha v'hedyot, when someone gives you a bracha, so some of us, if we think we're very important, might be tempted to dismiss the bracha. So if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is acknowledging and appreciating and thanking Rabbi Yishmael for his bracha, even though what is Rabbi Yishmael's bracha going to do for God? So certainly when we encounter other people and they give us thanks and they give us bracha, you never know how God's cheshbonos work out. We all tend to think that we are the most important thing in the world and no one else is our equivalent. But sometimes the hedyot maybe is not such a hedyot. And one should be appreciative of the birchas hedyot. It shouldn't be kala beinecha. It shouldn't be something taken lightly and dismissed. It's something that should be appreciated. Okay, we will stop here, and we're going to resume next time with another statement of Rabbi Yochanan Mishum, probably Rabbi Yosef ben Zimra, and we're going to have several of those.
Amen.
Any questions before we stop?
My leader.
Marshall's here.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, Marshall.
Oh, all week, I've been waiting to know about Yemenites heating up soup.
I apologize. It slipped my mind. I will be neither today. I'm going to stop this recording.